The town may be kind of small, but these folks have big smiles and big hearts. And they know what it is to have simple fun down our way. Where old-fashioned singing and homey gatherings make living mighty pleasant.
Yeah, Richie and I, when we talk about this entire BMG Salsa thing, we laugh a lot. Yeah,
I'm not even involved, and I've got a little agita.
We laugh a lot because we never had to pay an attorney. Not once.
Dave's rolling.
Welcome to Abandoned Albums, the documentary podcast where we take a closer look at some albums that may have been forgotten about over time, some albums you might not know existed, and some albums by some new, or at least new to us, artists we think you should know about. I'm your host, Keith R. Higgins, and on this episode of Abandoned Albums, we're going dancing. Ever since it was known as New Amsterdam, New York City has always been a melting pot. In the 1970s, that cauldron was boiling over with different cultures, crime, races, drugs, religions, income disparity, and of course, creativity. When it came to music, two genres would emerge to define New York City in the 1970s. One was punk, headquartered at the cramped dirt and dust of the downtown club CBGB's, and the other was the underground dance music popular at many dance and gay clubs. The music that would soon be called disco and make its way into the flash and flame of primetime at the famed Midtown Dance Cavern, Studio 54.
Disco will never be over. It will always live in our minds and hearts. Something like this, that was this big and this important and this great, will never die. Oh, for a few years, maybe many years, it'll be considered passé and ridiculous. It'll be misrepresented and caricatured and sneered at, or worse, completely ignored. Those who didn't understand will never understand. Disco was much more and much better than all that. Disco was too great and too much fun to be gone forever. It's got to come back someday. I just hope it will be in our own lifetimes.
One of the forefathers of this genre was the musically gifted and extremely prolific Richie Weeks. By day, Richie Weeks was a postal worker, and by night, he was a musical genius. Weeks created a monolithic catalog of genre-defining songs under different names like The Jammers, The Love Magician, and Weeks & Company. It was with Weeks & Company that he scored his biggest hit, 1981's Rock Your World, which made its way into the top 10 of Billboard's dance chart. Weeks was well-known and highly regarded in this boogie wonderland, so much so that producer and genre impresario Patrick Adams once favorably compared Richie's prowess in the recording studio to that of Quincy Jones. After disco's implosion, Weeks kept his job at the post office, retired with his pension, joined the Bricklayers Union, and continued to create his own music and work with artists around the world. Richie tapped into and explored a number of different genres, including house music, jazz, and pop, but always seemed to come up short with his music reaching critical mass. In 2018, Richie connected with DJ producer and head of Chicago's Past Due Records, Jerome Duraggi, and the two began a friendship that blossomed into a partnership. A partnership that would see Jerome spearhead the arduous task of wrestling Richie's creative rights back from BMG Rights Management. At the same time, Jerome was sifting through and digitizing all of Weeks' recorded material, over three decades' worth of hidden treasures that would rival Prince's famed vault of music. Digitizing the cassette tapes, reel-to-reel tapes, and the long-lost vinyl of the Richie Weeks catalog certainly rivaled the back-breaking business of legal jousting with an international music conglomerate, but was undoubtedly easier on the soul. Both Richie and Jerome stopped by Thunderlove Studios to talk about all of this in the release of their first album together. Richie Weeks, The Love Magician Archives, Volume 1, 1978-79. Here's my conversation with Richie and Jerome.
Thank you, guys. Richie Weeks and Jerome Duraggi. Thanks for joining.
Thanks for having us.
Richie, I want to ask you, how did you get channeled into music?
My father sang. He sang to me when I was a kid, but I mean, he had a record out by Dion and the Belmonts called I Wonder Why. He had taken me into studios after that. I just fell in love with studio. The mixing board, you know, the pianos and all the instruments that were in there. And I was only, I think, about 8 or 9 when I had that experience. Prior to that, I sang in a talent show that was in a boarding school in Staten Island. And I won first prize. Everybody was bugging out. They were just screaming, he's so talented. You know, like, I didn't know what the hell they were talking about. At 6 years old, I couldn't decipher what that was, but it felt good, you know.
That's great.
My mom was a singer. Grandmother was a nightclub singer.
Oh, wow.
And I have sisters and brothers and cousins that sing. I have a cousin named Michelle Weeks. She has records out on the charts. And my brother Sheldon is the lead singer on a group that I formed called The Jammers.
Very cool. So it's it runs in the family, obviously.
Yeah.
Jerome, are you a musician yourself?
Yeah, I'm a producer, yeah. I play a bunch of machines, keyboards, and drums, guitars, and bass.
And are you like Richie in that sense? It goes back to your childhood.
So it's actually nobody in my family really ever made music or played music. And I'm the only one that really wanted to. And I learned on my own with a tiny guitar. And then I bought a keyboard. And then I, you know, like the old school way, I started a garage band. And here we are.
I just can't help but think of what New York City must have been like during that era, Richie. I mean, we hear stories about it now, you know, Studio 54 and disco, and you were right in the heart of it.
Yeah.
Not only were you part of it, not only were you making music, you had a job. You worked at the post office.
When I got out of college, I jumped right into the post office. And after that, I met some of the students that I was working with. The college, you know, they wanted to sing, start a group. And I said, okay, let's get together. So we got together. We started playing with harmonies. And they liked what I sounded like. And they said, okay, so let's form a group. So we got like five guys. And then we started singing. And then we called ourselves the Fascinators. With that, we moved on. And we had one of the guys in the group was from the Polo Grounds in Manhattan. Mm-hmm. He had known Timmy Lyman and he knew Frankie Lyman. And he introduced me to them and so forth. And Timmy was, you know, I think it was around 9 or 10, maybe 11, I think it was. And we got together, we started singing, and they said, wow, this is nice. So what happened was we ended up getting on the Apollo stage. And we worked with Tommy Hunt and Chuck Jackson, and we won the actual show. It turned out to be really good. That was a hell of an experience for me. And then from there, it just started getting, you know, larger. It just started getting like, you know, started meeting a lot of people and stuff like that. Fascinators were offered a deal with I think it was Capitol or Columbia. What do you call it? Timmy's older brother, Frankie, didn't want him to come out of school. He wanted him to finish school. So he said, nah, that ain't going to work. So that came apart. And then after that, you know, the group just disbanded. You know, we went our separate ways, although I still was staying with Paul Simon, not the Simon, but Paul Simon's another gentleman that I had at college. And he said, let's form another group. And we formed another group called Central Park West. And then, would you know it, we ended up back at the Apollo. And we came in first again. We were singing other songs with Earth, Wind, and Fire songs. And the crowd went crazy. So that woke me up. I said, wow, this is great. You know, after that, we ventured off into meeting professional people like Patrick Adams, Leroy Burgess, Jorge Barrero, who was my co-writer for Rock Your World. And one thing led to the next. You know, me and Jorge did some tracks, and we did a track called I Just Don't Want to Lose It. Then I met Patrick with more situations. Like, he wanted me to go into that studio because he heard my voice and heard what I was doing. He said, man, I'll put you in the studio. He said, just do what you feel. You know, I know you got songs. I said, yeah. I must have run about 20 songs right off the cuff, you know. And then it got back to him. And he said, wow, this is nice. So, you know, with that, then the tracks were just sitting. Because Patrick was so busy. He was doing, like, Heard You Man. He was doing Push in the Bush.
Yep. I discovered that today. And I was like, my God, I remember this song.
And he also did stuff with Jocelyn Brown, I'm caught up in a one night love affair. Oh, he was all over the place. He had so much work that he just didn't have time to give back to me. I was concerned about that. So anyway, I went in the studio on my own and just wrote my own song called Who Cares. I wrote the strings, the horns, and I went in there and I did I played the drums, I played the keyboards and stuff like that. I hired a few guys that I met that we formed a band when I was in college, or when I had just gotten out of college, and they were in there, and you know, we put the song together, and it sounded great. Right after that, I met a gentleman by the name of Roy Albayan. That name is all the members of the crew and the gang that were family. Okay. So what happened was, Roy Al said, "Cool's coming over your house. Cool and the gang is coming over to your house. Be there." I said, "Okay." So then the whole band didn't come. Just the girls came, something sweet to call themselves. George, the drummer, and Amir, I think he was a guitar player. They came over to the house and they sat in the house and, you know, I said, "Okay, Rich, we got it." So I had a 2-inch, I had a Pioneer open reel deck. I had my saw on there and I put it on. And they said, "Oh, wow." So then while I was playing it, I said, "Look, I'm going to go out and get something for you guys, man, because I don't normally have anything here for you to drink and stuff like that." So when I went out to get something to drink, I came back there and said, "Yo, Rich, we heard enough. We're leaving." I said, "Because we got another appointment." I said, "Okay." So I asked them, they're like, "Yeah, man, we're going to get back to you." So they left. And then 30 days later, Patrick calls me up and says, "Turn on BLS." So I turned on BLS, and BLS is playing Ladies Night. So I listened to it. I said, "Man, this sounds like Mountain." I said, "The bass is the same. The rhythm is the same." So I said, "Wow." So he said, "Did you make a deal with them? Did you strike a deal with them on the side and exclude me?" I said, "No, nah, man, I wouldn't do nothing like that." So he said, "Well, I don't know." I said, "Well, hey, man, we're going to sue them. That's all." He said, "No, we can't do that, man. We can't do that because the label that they were on, it was owned by the mafia, I believe. They had something to do with it." So I just said, "What are we going to do?" He said, just hold tight. Just sit around." So I just sat around, you know. And then after that, I got in touch with Jorge, back with him, and we met a few other people in the studio, and we decided to put together Rock Your World. And we did that. It turned out to be successful, and they said, "Oh, this is going to be a smash," whatever. After that, I totally forgot about the other cash.
Jerome, your musical background, what led you to music?
Well, the playing is not really in my family, but the listening is really in my family. So my dad loves music, and my brother too. Actually, my brother was like an old punk rocker at the time. So I heard and listened to music all my life. when I was a kid. At 12 years old, I did an expose in my music class about punk rock.
Really?
Yeah, and I played, you know, the Ramones and all that stuff. And I was 12. Also, I think in middle school, we had an essay to do in French, and I did a poem instead of an essay. And my music teacher put it into a musical.
Wow.
So I've always been kind of versed into that. I always loved records. I always loved digging. And contrary to a lot of my friends, instead of buying drugs, I bought records when I was a kid.
Really?
That was my thing. That was records were my drug. So I've always, and I used to go to tons of shows. I went to my first rock concert. I was 12 years old also.
Who was it?
A French band called Béruyer Noir, which was became one of the biggest punk rock ever alternative band in France. Mm-hmm. When I saw them, I think that was their first tour. There was probably like 100 people in the room, not even.
Wow.
So I was always in the music realm, always bought tons of records. I was dug for stuff that nobody really knew about. I read a lot about it. Yeah. And kind of always dreamt about having my own label. I think I remember when 15, I read about Berry Gordy, and I was like, this is freaking amazing. And I was like, I wish one day I can do the same, you know, start my own company, you know.
Lo and behold, you did.
Yeah.
Richie, I can't wrap my head around. I have two jobs now. Man, I'm exhausted. The energy that it takes to be creative like you are, writing in a studio, singing, organizing, that's pretty draining work.
Yeah, it is. But I mean, I just had the energy. I just had the energy and the love for it. And I just said, wow, I'm just going to burn the candle on both ends, you know?
Given the period, the 70s, we all know that, you know, there was a certain substance that was very popular in the club community, probably still is. I can't help but wonder if that didn't fuel any creativity in the scene that you were in.
No, my mind wasn't nowhere near that. I didn't do anything. You know, I just got high on my music, you know, and I still do that today. It's amazing. But I mean, the reason why is because I've seen people get strung out that were in the business in the industry. And I used to look at them and like, nah, that ain't gonna happen to me. You know, plus on top of that, I was working for the post office, a government job, so I couldn't do that, you know?
You know, Jerome sent me over the Love Magician album, and I have to tell you, I think it's truly wonderful what you guys have done. Out of all the songs there's only one that's not written by you, Richie. And I'm curious to know what the reasoning was. It just seems sort of, I noticed it right away. I'm like, oh, that's the one Richie didn't write. And I love it. Don't get me wrong. I love the song.
I know what it is too, just because I don't dance.
yeah. That's it. That's it.
Let me get my act together. Hey, sugar. You want to come on and dance with me?
Sorry, babe. I don't dance.
You don't dance? What? Last time I asked you, oh, anything, you were right about it. Sure. You leave it. I ain't even dance there every time.
Oh, wait a minute. Don't go any place. I mean,
well, you can't dance.
But you don't have to leave.
Goodbye.
Just because I don't dance don't mean I don't know how to party. Just because I don't dance don't mean I don't know how to party.
Well, tell me, baby, what happened? What happened over there?
He said he doesn't dance.
Oh, my goodness. Well, maybe you should have went over there and talked to him. Talk to him a little more. See what he says.
I'm not so nervous.
Oh, you're nervous. Oh, wait a minute. Here he comes.
I want to dance the next slow one.
Well, okay.
You know, I never really learned how to do fancy steps, but I could try. You know, I could really get close and hold you close to me and all that kind of jazz.
Oh, Lord.
You know what I mean?
Well, if you want to try, let's do it.
Well, I mean, you say the word, but let's get it on.
Just because I don't dance don't mean I don't know how to party.
We we get together, musicians get together, we play around and stuff like that, you know, with tunes and stuff like that. Otto, my guitar player, he was hyper like me. And he just said, "Yo, Rich, I got something nice." So he started playing around, and then Harris jumped in, Harris Punyon, my keyboard player. And we all started, you know, just vibing on it. So what happened was, you know, I said, "Wow, this is nice. So you want to put it down?" "Yeah, why not?" We had a little free time, so we just figured we include that. And it turned out okay. We had two versions. We did one version where we had the background singers, you know, making like they were, you know, at a club and they were, you know, having fun and stuff like that. And some guy was looking at him, one of the girls, and he wanted to dance or whatever. And the other track was just, you know, the chanting, you know, "Just cause I don't dance don't mean I don't know how to party," you know, that kind of thing. And, you know, it just sounded so well. So because of the fact that it was my session and it was, you know, my production, I just put it on. I said, "Well, let's keep this on the album," you know, and Jerome liked it.
One of the reasons I love that song is that I can totally identify with it. The musicianship is just amazing. In particular, the one that really stood out to me is your bass player, Norbert Slowly?
Norbert Slowly, yeah.
Man, that guy's on fire.
Oh, yeah, he was on fire.
Are these guys that you knew from college or just bopping around doing the music stuff? Or were they studio guys?
These are studio guys that Patrick was using. And he said, "I'm going to give you all the best I got to go to the studio and come up with some good stuff." And, you know, I said, "Okay, no problem." And I just told them, basically, you know, showed them the charts and stuff and let them see what was going on. And they said, "We got it, Rich, we got it." And I told them, I said, "Just put your personality in it, make it sound, you know, like we're really, you know, out to get something." And they did just that. I told them to just do what they felt that would make things happen. And that's what they did. They were that good.
When you first heard Richie's music, what was your first reaction?
I'm a DJ. So I've been playing Richie's music forever. So I knew who Richie was. I was a huge fan of Richie. I played tons of disco in my sets. And so Richie's music was always in my sets. When my friend Henry told me, it's Henry Claude, told me, you know, "You got to talk to Richie." I was like, "Are you kidding me? I'm going to be able to talk to this guy? He's amazing." So that's really that already. He's like, you're talking to, you know, this genius that you've never, you know, you didn't even know he was still around. So I felt really blessed and honored.
How did you produce it?
It was quite a long process, because I believe I basically bought totes on Amazon and shipped those totes to Richie. And we get batches of, like, basically we'll do one tote at a time. And then I will get everything transferred in a studio down the street from where I live. I'm really lucky. Everything will be digitized. I will clean it up. And then I will catalog it with the tapes, take pictures of every tape and stuff. Put that on a hard drive, put everything back in the box with the tapes, send that back to Richie. And I think we did that 3 or 4 times. So at the end, I mean, through the process, I'm discovering the music and I'm losing my mind because I was like stunned by how amazing it was. It was literally amazing. Just discovering that, you know that Richie Weeks is a genius for the stuff he did on South Soul and Prelude. And then you hear all this stuff and you're like, this is unbelievable. And so, yeah, so I cataloged and archived everything and we restored everything. Slowly but surely, and then it got really overwhelming. It took me more than a year to absorb the music, to be able to actually talk to Richie about a specific song and see how we were going to compile it and release it, because you can't release 300 songs at once. You can't do anything that way. So, and we really wanted to do vinyl, because that's the only way this stuff is going to sound the right way. So it took me a long time to really figure it out while we were working on Richie's rights anyway. So that was fine. But yeah, that's basically the process. Just take your time and, you know, be focused, and then archive everything and catalog everything.
So we'll back up a little bit. And I guess it was the early 80s that everything sort of went, the label sort of folded up shop on you, Richie, and you just...
Taking a step back a bit, Patrick decided that the best move to make, in other words, because of what happened with Kool and the Gang, he said, let me set some up. So what he did was, he was already on Salso. He called him up and said, yo, I got a guy here that's you know, you're not going to believe it. So next thing I know, I got a call that weekend, and it was Salso Records. They said, excuse me, Richie. I said, yes. This is Salso Records. I'm like, whoa. So they said, I understand you got some product, music and stuff like that. I said, yes, sir. He said, well, can you get it in hand so we can hear it? I said, no problem. So I went down there that Monday, Salso Records, and I met Glenn LaRusso and I met Ken Carey. And I sat in Ken's office, and he listened to me. He said, oh, yeah, this is nice. He said, okay, so how much do you want? I said, excuse me? He said, how much do you want? I said, I didn't know how to answer that. I said, I don't know. Whatever you guys give me, I guess. He said, okay, where can we get the tapes? I said, they're in the studio. He said, okay, we're going to buy the tapes from the studio. What studios are they in? So I told him all the different studios. And he went and just got all the music and brought it back to Salso. And he said, okay, do you do? So I said, wow. After that, everything just started happening. It just started coming together. So, you know, I felt good. I mean, you know, and then after I met Jerome, you know, I just, after Claude from France told me about Jerome, yes. And he said, you know, this guy's an angel, man. You're going to love this guy. I got on the phone with him, and it was, the chemistry was right. You know, and he said, Rich, let's do this. I said, okay. So he said, he told me what he wanted, and I just, he sent me some totes. It was big totes, and I put the tracks in there and stuff like that and sent it to him, and the rest is history.
Richie did exactly what he was supposed to do. He kept a recording of everything he's done.
Yeah.
And he preserved it. And it's his legacy. You know?
Sure is.
Life's work.
Richie, during that period, like the 80s, were you still going in the studio and recording?
I was always recording. I was doing separate acts, different acts. I was just, you know, laying down the tracks, playing all the music and stuff like that. And then I would go in the studio on my own and just make tracks. And then I'd put groups together to get on stage to do tracks. I also worked with Lloyd Price, the gentleman that made Stagger Lee. And I worked with him. I did an album with him.
Wow.
And I also did an album with Instant Funk, this group out of New Jersey. And that was on Salso. I did two tracks for them, produced it and everything. And it came out on their last album. I believe it was album 5. I also did work with Melissa Morgan. She worked with Kashif. You remember Kashif, right?
Oh, yeah, man, Kashif.
I don't know.
He was a pretty big producer as well. I worked with him, Melissa Morgan, rather. You know, then she left Salso and went to Kashif, and she had a couple of hits out there. I still got tracks on her.
But so the thing that people don't really know about Richie is, first, the success he had with Salso and Rock Your World made him a very in-demand producer. So there's stories about Japanese producers coming to New York, hiring Richie to make tracks for them. So he worked also with that in the UK for the Hudsons, a bunch of brothers that were doing funk at the time. And they were on Streetwave, I think. But the thing that people don't know is when Salso closed, Richie wasn't really left, you know, and didn't do music. He continued working at the post office. And then he hooked up with another Frenchman and he started a bunch of house music labels. And Richie and his guy did dozens and dozens and dozens of house records and acid jazz records too in the 90s. Some of them are really, really famous and really popular. So Richie, you know, in the 90s, Richie's done tons of R&B and hip hop. Richie is an actual real musical prodigy. He never stopped making music. He still makes music today. And it's still great.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable.
Keith, I have like 140 tracks on SoundCloud. These are brand new tracks. It's called Richie Weeks at SoundCloud.com and also QMAX, QUEMAXX Music LLC. I have two pages. And, you know, I just, when I have a studio in my house, so what I do is I just, when I finish the pre-production and stuff like that, and I take the tracks and I put them on SoundCloud.
You are a productive man.
Yeah, very much so.
What motivates you creatively?
Well, it's first of all, it's my Lord, my God, you know. He motivates me. He keeps me going. I mean, all I do is ask him to have patience, you know. And I just, when I go into the studio and I do my music, I think about, you know, what I want to do, how I want to do it. And like I said, music to me is like heroin to an addict.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, but in a positive sense, not negatively. So I feel, you know, I just like the way music sounds to my ears. You know, it's like candy, you know. I just hope I don't get diabetes, you know.
I don't think you can.
It's a beautiful thing. I mean, because it, you know, like I said, I just love it, you know. And I'm with Jerome now, so you know, I know that we're in good hands, you know.
We have The Love Magician out now. Jerome, I'm sure you have a plan to release the records. Will there be a cadence to them?
We're trying like every 4 or 5 months. Again, because it's overwhelming if we do it every month. It's too much music for people to absorb, I think. We want to make sure that everybody has a chance to get the records as they come out and kind of hear them and understand what it is. But volume 2 is already ready to go. We're waiting to manufacture, actually. We're already done with that one. There's so much music. It's incredible. I think the you know, we're not going to release everything. It's impossible. And also because Richie, in his prolific manner, he made songs, sometimes 8-9 different versions of the same song. Mm-hmm. And that's something that was really, really surprising to me. I know that, you know, artists record a couple of versions, usually, or 3 versions. I've never heard 8 versions of the same song, and each one is different. Different arrangements, different parts, different music lines and licks, and sometimes vocals. It's absolutely mind-blowing. You can hear stuff where Richie's mixing live on the console. You can hear the stuff he's experimenting on. So not only is he writing the music, playing on it, he's got his guys, he's got the vocalists, him sometimes doing versions where he sings so he can show to a vocalist what it needs to sound like. But then you've got the final versions with Richie at the console mixing everything, putting effects and changing. It's absolutely crazy. And, you know, it's not 3-minute songs. It's like 10-minute songs.
Yeah.
It's mind-blowing. Absolutely. I think to me that was, you know, beyond the absolutely awesomeness of each song, that's the stuff that blew my mind. It's this incredible way of producing music.
I also like to mention that I was doing jazz too. I was doing acid jazz.
Yeah,
The crazy Frenchman, Renaud Deschamps. He's in France. I did some cuts with him, and they did pretty well overseas. But I mean, you know, I had a variety of different genres that I went into: rap, R&B, pop. You know, I even tried to do classic, you know.
Jerome and I were talking before you joined, Richie. What I found particularly cool on The Love Magician is, like I mentioned earlier, the degree of musicianship. This was all done in the studio. So there's, like, when I listen to the drums, I'm like, there's no click track. Not in 1976, 77, 78. These guys are all playing live.
That's right.
I mean, and you're orchestrating the whole thing.
Yeah.
It's kind of jaw-dropping to think of what you were doing.
I was an avid listener to Quincy Jones.
Ah, okay.
I love this stuff, you know.
I suspect the response has been pretty positive with The Love Magician. Do I have that correct?
Yeah, yeah. So far, the response is great. Our issue is the plant is backed up, so we still don't have the vinyl out and the CD out. I think that's going to be a nice response once it comes out, because it's on a really thick vinyl and we did a really cool package. There's the beginning of his story written in it.
Jerome, when you connected with Richie, Did you have a plan?
The plan was to help Richie get his rights back.
Yeah.
From BMG Salsoul, and we issued the Jammers and Weeks and Company. Okay. I just had no idea about the unreleased stuff. So we did that already. We reissued the Jammers and Weeks and Company. We actually squeezed in there an unreleased track that was coming from the tapes. It was kind of a hint. But I had no idea about the rest. And so, of course, when Richie started telling me about the tapes, I had to get another plan together. And I think Richie was pretty clever about it too, because he didn't tell me everything at once. So he'd be like, I got a couple of tapes. And then from a couple of tapes, it'll be like 100. You know, from 100, it'll be 200. And then it'll be like, oh, but you know, I also have cassettes and I found more tapes.
I got stuff on DAT.
On that, yeah, he's got DATs too that we haven't even touched yet. Because the DATs are basically what I said to Richie. At this point, we got to start from the beginning. So let's start in the 70s, go through all the 80s, 85, 86. And then when we reach that time, we're going to go for the rest, you know, the house stuff. So there's so much more that we're going to work on. But that was really that. That was hilarious. Like Richie will be like, oh, I get cassettes. I got garbage bags full of cassettes.
Garbage bags full of cassettes.
And so, I have a tape player and he sent me, I think it was at least more than 100 cassettes. And I transferred everything myself here in my house. It was a lot of fun. It was awesome. I mean, I said to Richie what I said to a bunch of artists is, especially artists that are on major labels, I can help you. I can go to the major label, get your rights back, get you paid if they owe you some money, and reissue your music. The thing is, I had no idea Richie had so much music unreleased from back in the days. Nobody even knew about that. And so, you know, basically that what we agreed to do is I got to get to work and get his rights back from Salso and Prelude.
I interviewed Erwin Chusid recently, who had to do the same thing with Raymond Scott and Sun Ra. He said it was quite a hassle.
Oh, yeah. And I think that's the story that the New York Times didn't really want to talk about. Unfortunately, I think they run out of room. That's what they said. But the story is really way more complex than that.
Can I just interrupt for 1 second? Because I read that article. Yeah. And that guy from BMG, it's 2022. And he's like, oh, well, we didn't have his address.
Well, that was complete.
I get the bank information. Okay, fine.
No, that was complete bullshit.
Of course it was. It's I could probably find it right now in a matter of seconds for Richie.
Yeah, I mean, it was this guy is a funny guy. Basically, Richie, are you okay if I talk about this?
Yeah, go ahead, man.
The Honorable Henry T. Fleming, should go right to fucking jail! The son of a bitch is guilty! If he's allowed to go free, then something really wrong is going on.
Mr. Kirkland, you are out of order!
You're out of order! You're out of order! The whole trial is out of order!
This is how it works. So, there's a bipartisan bill that was passed in Congress, I think in 2013, that's called the Termination of Transfers and Copyrights. Mm-hmm. So it's a federal law. It allows artists under Section 203 to claim their copyrights back. Copyrights means, you know, songwriting rights and publishing from labels or companies that own them after 35 years. The process is complex, but not too hard. It is such that you can do it without an attorney. And the cost of it is around $100.
Get out. No. Let's just recap.
No, that's real. This is true. Yeah, it's
so after 30, is it 35 years?
The 35 years time frame. You've got 10 years to file the notices because you get to send a notice to the label or the rights holder and to the copyright office. And the notice is 2-year notice. So you send them the paperwork and then you got to wait 2 years to get your rights back. That's when the label is cooperative. What happened with BMG and Sal Soul is owned in quotes. I will say in quotes because you can't really own a company that was bankrupt unless if you resign all the artists, and you can't release their music digitally unless if you resign them also, which none of those labels do. That's why Eminem sued his label and tons of other people did that. I managed to find the contact of the people at BMG Sarsel, and I served them with the notice. And of course, they were not really happy with it because Richie's work is classic. It's worth a lot of money for a huge corporation. And then it was a battle, and it was insane. And they gave us the runaround for almost 2 years. But we filed the paperwork, the copyright office. That's the cool part, is you can send a notice to the label. You're still filing at the same time paperwork with the copyright office. The copyright office is the entity that's going to revert the rights back to the artist. Mm-hmm. That the label agrees or disagree, they have to follow the law. They don't have a choice. But, you know, some labels don't agree with that and don't follow the law. And so the battle with BMG, I mean, this can be a scoop for you. It became pretty heated because they basically started ignoring our emails, even if we had the rights back. And what happened is the entire George Floyd protests happened. Mm-hmm. And I happened to be on a newsletter that's called the Digital Music News. It's a really, really great newsletter. And one day around the time of the George Floyd protests, I get a newsletter that I read every day. And in there was an article saying that BMG made a press release talking about how they treat Black artists and that they were going to go and review the way, you know, their legacy contracts are with Black artists because they felt bad or something, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
And so I was like, after 2 years of fighting them to get Richie's rights back, you know, and his money because he hasn't never been paid by them at that time.
What?
Yeah. And that's another story also. I read this and I got outraged. And I sent them an email saying, how dare you? How dare you use George Floyd and say you're going to basically go back and do the right thing when you're not doing the right thing. And Richie's a Black artist and you haven't done crap for him. And I sent that to the CEO of BMG, which is in Germany. He's the number two of the company too. All his execs, all the VPs of legal. And the number two of the company did something fantastic. He responded to the email to forward it to his team. It was all his team. All the execs were in there.
Uh-huh.
And he forgot to take me off the email. And he said, let's make sure this guy doesn't go to the press.
What?
Because I said, I'm going to go to the press. If you're not doing the right thing for Richie, I will go to the press and I will tell them what you did and what you're doing and that you're lying about your press release. So he sent that email, to which I responded, there was a very formal letter that said, you know, how dare you again? You know, we've got a black artist at the time. Richie lived in Florida. He was repairing AC units in 100-degree weather because he wasn't paid. And he's like, you know, in the 70s. And I said, you know, will you explain to your children why a black man that made such great music has to go fix AC units when he's the age of their grandfather? And you will not even dare doing that to your own father. Stuff like this. From there, the guy called me. We had a long conversation and he said he was going to work with me. And then it became this crazy thing. They tried to hire me to work on South Soul. I refused. I told them basically, I will work on South Soul if you pay everybody, which they never did want to do that. And also if you return the rights to everybody or resign agreements with everybody, which because that's the best way to do it. And so while all this is going on, I'm fighting them to get Richie's rights back. We're fighting them to respect the initial contract that South Soul did, because once they started wanting to pay Richie, they basically invented their own royalties. None of them matched the initial contract. So we had to go back to the contract and tell them pretty much everything. This is how you read the contract. Richie owns 50% of everything. He gets a 50% royalty for everything. In the digital, because he wasn't released on digital at the time, it's a license. He owns 50% of that. So you got to pay him 50% of that, which they were fighting and all that stuff. So it took, I think all that took three and a half years, I think, 3 years.
Yeah.
We, you know, they ended up signing a contract with us. I think the guy that's on the article in the New York Times is the one that wrote the contract. I think 5-6 times he tried to put some clause in the contract where you could claim all Richie's rights back. it was really sneaky stuff. But we get his rights back. We have a contract from BMG. And then we continue fighting after that because BMG didn't withdraw the publishing, continued exploiting the digital, and then even released the record with Richie's music on it. And it lasted for a while. And so it was a complete constant fight until we got the publishing sorted back to Richie, all these copyrights sorted back. Altogether, I think we collected, I'm not going to say the amount, but a decent amount of money for him. And all that money went to him, didn't come to us. I gave all of that money to Richie, and he's got his rights back. He's got the copyrights. He's got the publishing. He's in entire possession of his catalog. And I even had Richie sign with our sub-publisher. So Richie has all his catalog published for the world.
Awesome.
So that was Dante. It's a very long story. There's crazy stuff that happened around this. And I've got everything documented. But it's to give you an example. You can get your rights back, but the labels will fight you to the death.
Can I ask a question? This is for my own edification.
Yeah.
As they continue to exploit the catalog now, and you eventually get the copyright back, will they have to retroactively pay you?
Unless if you sue them, and nobody can afford that. Filing a lawsuit in the US for copyright infringement is going to cost you $20,000-$30,000, you know? And I mean, and the label is going to do everything for you not to see a conning and all that stuff, and you'll never be able to get money for them. I have to say, in the case of BMG, as much as they fought us, the number two of the company still, without his help, with his mistakes and his help, still made it happen. And that was kind of like really, he's a good guy in the bad vibe that all that stuff was. You know, I remember telling them, you're paying attorneys hundreds of thousands of dollars, you know, on staff to fight a guy that has no money and to not pay him anything. And not giving him his rights back, and that's the law. I'm like, there's something really odd here about the way you're working. When you could actually, legally, you could have just basically used your attorneys to sign the guy, pay him the money you owe him, which is really a drop in the sea of all the revenue you're making with all the music you're exploiting, and have somebody on your side. They didn't want to do that. And, you know, they don't do that. They miss 300 unreleased songs from the 70s and the 80s. That's what those labels do. And the funny part that happened while I'm fighting them is because I told them, you know, the entire thing about South Soul was, why don't you tell the story of all the artists on South Soul, which is what I'm doing with Richie. Why don't you go back? There's some of them are still around and do shows with them Their music is so popular still today. Tons of kids, DJs, young DJs are playing Salsoul records and Prelude records. Those two labels are a monument to dance music, to the history of dance music. They are essential American icons. And the artists that are on Salsoul are essential to dance music and music in the world. Their influence is, you know, unbelievable. And the legacy is forever. And I remember, you know, telling them all that stuff, do the right thing, which they didn't do. And they still did also commission an investigation in their practices with Black artists. So they paid somebody to investigate their practices. And then they were happy to report, you know, a few months later that everything was great.
And this is BMG that did that.
Yeah, that was BMG investigating themselves on their relationships with Black artists and then doing a press release. You know, we're great. Thank you very much.
God, that's ridiculous.
It was absolutely amazing to be able to witness that while you're dealing with them and while you're having conversations with literally the head of the catalog in for the world, head of the catalog in the US, you know, the VP of the basically the CEO of the company. It's amazing. So it's cool. I said it. Nobody knew about this except a few people. Now it's out there.
What's the next step for you guys?
I mean, the plan is continue releasing the records, try to get Richie to get with a band back together and work on a new album. That's what we're doing. We're working on a brand new album also of Richie's recordings.
Is there an opportunity that you'll be playing live?
Well, I'm trying to get Richie back to with the guys and get his band back pretty much and see if we can get him some gigs. It'll be amazing.
Richie, I'm very happy that you got your rights back and your songs back. I can't thank you guys enough for taking the time and talking to me. It's a fascinating story. Both of you have. This is an ideal story for a documentary film.
It's not the priority. The priority is Richie and his music right now. And
for sure.
Making sure that people can hear everything he's done and get him on the road maybe if we can. That would be awesome.
That's awesome. Richie, thank you. I'm so glad that I've discovered you.
Thank you.
Jerome, thank you very much as well. I wish you both much success with everything that you're doing.
Thanks so much, Keith. Thanks for having us. It was really cool. You take care.
Bye-bye.
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 Many thanks to Richie and Jerome for stopping by Thunder Love Studios. The songs you heard during this podcast were Rock Your World, Just Cause I Don't Dance, and The Beat of the Times. Be sure to check out Richie's music wherever you stream your favorite music or on SoundCloud, both of which you can find links to in the show notes. You also heard a clip from the movie The Last Days of Disco, directed by Whit Stillman, and the movie And Justice for All, directed by Norman Jewison. Our theme song is Rocket Sled by Blip. Special thanks to Jeff Calhoun. Please be sure to check out the episode notes. We'll have links there for all the stuff that you're probably scratching your head about now. Abandoned Albums was recorded at Thunder Love Studios.
Produced and written by Keith R. Higgins.
Engineered and mixed by Steve Beasley. Edited by A.J. Royce.
Original music by Mike Pellegrino.
If you like what you've heard, please be sure to subscribe and leave us a rating. It really does help. Thanks for listening.
At Twitter, we are at Abandoned Albums. And on Instagram, we are at Abandoned_albums.
Grazie.
Bailey Leaf, Rob Janicki, S.W. Loudon, Michael Janicki, Steve Beasley, Mike Pellegrino, Therina Bella, Peyton Janicki, and of course, our executive producer.
This is Thunder Love.
And now, until we meet again next time, I remain as always obediently yours.
Abandoned Albums is a production of Paw Print Media.